If you have read anything on divorce in the Bible, the chances are high that you have read about Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, an Old Testament passage that figures prominently in later Old Testament and New Testament teaching on divorce. However, while divorce is present in Deuteronomy 24, the burden of the passage is elsewhere, in a deeper and more grievous reality that this particular divorce action illustrates. In this lecture, Dr. Rebecca Josberger of Multnomah University explains the role of abuse in this familiar text and connects its immediate concern with the more general pulse beat of the Torah. Thank you for your support of Greystone Theological Institute and the Lydia Center for Women and Families. And now, Lecture 3, Dr. Rebecca Josberger, Torah as Protector of the Vulnerable, Deuteronomy 24 as Abuse Text.
All right, good morning or afternoon, depending on your time zone, Valerie. I am unbelievably honored to be here. I'm Dr. Josberger. I was introduced earlier by Mark. I was honored to be asked to this, to come here, but I was even more honored when I heard the two papers that were presented so far to be part of a conversation that I respect so highly. I'm going to be reading a paper to you in this first session, and then later on this afternoon we'll unpack things. It'll be more, I won't read it, I'm just going to teach. I'm a teacher by trade. But before I read the paper, I want to give just a little bit of introduction, because the paper in my life has context. And for me, everything that I study is understood through context. I believe that in scholarly work, but I also know that I have a personal bent toward that. So the context itself is going to be important. As far as the history of the work go, the paper that I'm going to read to you today comes out of work that I did on my dissertation. I'm trying to remember the years. I believe I finished in 2008, so it's been in progress for quite some time. The dissertation work was suggested to me by Dr. Block. He was very interested in the topic of Deuteronomy, obviously a passion I have adopted and probably run rampant with. And he was also interested in the role of father and what a patriarchal, or as he would call it, a patricentric culture looks like, where the father is the center of how society runs. And I had no independent thinking at this point. It was very new in studies, didn't know how to pick a topic to save my life. And so he recommended this topic in the very beginning of my PhD studies. And I'm going to be very candid. I was concerned about the topic being the role of the father in ancient Israel. It eventually morphed into the role of the father in prescriptive texts. Those are instructional texts. And what Dr. Block understood that I didn't at the time was that this was going to become an issue of authority, not just of family roles. But I, being very aware that I was a female in a field and in an environment evangelically where females are kind of new to the scene, was concerned about the topic. I didn't want to do a family issue and look girly. I wanted to be seen as a scholar. So if you read a paper and you see it's on the four uses of hotpa'al in the Hebrew grammar system as represented in the Old Testament, you don't care whether there's a feminine name underneath or a masculine name. I can stand on my own as a scholar. But if you read a paper on father and you look at the name underneath, if it's a male name, that's okay. Almost all scholars are males in this field. You don't think much of it. But if it's a female name, you wonder, well, what perspective? Is this going to be highly relational? And I was quite concerned. And Dr. Block very wisely and patiently said, I have done enough research in this field to know what you are going to find. But if I say it as a white evangelical male, it won't be heard. Because what I'm seeing is that in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, the father did have the authority, but he was called to exercise it well. And if that is said by a woman it will be heard because you will be supporting the role of the male in that culture rather than using it for your own use to get ahead. So I was kind of skeptical, but I agreed to go ahead. Now, the reason I share that is because it's the reality behind the issue, but it's also to share that I did not have a personal agenda when I was looking at these texts. In fact, I come from a very conservative upbringing, and some of the things that I found when I was working with the texts made me uncomfortable. And today's paper is an example of that. And you'll see what I mean when I read it. I would have come from the background that was addressed, that Valerie Hobbs just addressed, where divorce is wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong. Okay. And I have a phenomenal marriage. It is easy for me to sit in that and understand why divorce would be wrong, and marriage glorifies God. So I don't have an axe to grind on that issue. But what I found in my dissertation work, and I'll talk about this a lot more this afternoon, what I found in my dissertation work is that the texts that I chose, they were every text in the corpus of Deuteronomy, because when you do a dissertation, you really have to limit it, that instructed the head of household, the father, how he was to walk in righteousness in different situations. I had to limit the texts that I chose further because in ancient Israel, the head of household, the Beit Av, or the Av, is seen according to his role as both husband, which we don't include too much when we say father, parent to his children, servants, domestic livestock, and land. All of those are included when you speak in Hebrew of the word Av. That left the corpus of texts far too broad to examine in the depth that I needed to examine them, so I restricted them anachronistically to what I understand as the role of father, in other words, that of parent, but it could not be separated from the role, his role also as spouse. Now, what I've come to understand since then is the reason that dynamic works that way is because societally in Israel, the father is the focal point. He holds the ultimate authority. But familially, if that's even a word, within the family, the father and mother always function together. You'll hear people say sometimes, surprisingly, the woman is mentioned. Show me a time she's not mentioned, and I will be surprised. She's there, and she seems to walk equally with him. So there are spheres sociologically that they walk in, and they play different roles according to their sphere. So that's the background. Now, I am going to go on, and let me tell you what I found. What I found in the Old Testament, in these texts, was that there was an assumption made when the text is written, and that assumption is based in the setting. The setting is assumed. It is not prescribed. In other words, we assume often when we go to a text that if we read something that says it's how it was in a narrative or especially in an instruction, then that's how it was supposed to be. And we forget that God engages human culture in order to convey himself to us in a way that we can understand, but the culture in which he must enter and engage is broken. So the setting is usually not the instruction. Now, that might seem obvious, but we forget that when we read. We do. I see evidence of it all the time in casual conversation, in research and scholarship. So let me give you an example. When the text says, if you have two wives and love one and hate the other, that is not an instruction. This is a given. We understand this. Two have two wives, love one and hate the other. It is the setting of brokenness into which God gives Torah his instruction on how to walk righteously despite the brokenness. Now, that's going to be less clear for most culturally because of the culture that we're in when we come to the passage I'm going to discuss today, Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, the so-called divorce text. As I read, you will see me interacting with many scholars who believe that this is a text that guides us in how divorce can, should, or was carried out. And I would argue, no, it's the broken setting for which righteousness is addressed. The other finding in my dissertation, besides the fact that the Torah was given into settings of brokenness, were that it assumed within those settings a structure that included authority and power, and rightly so. That's a human dynamic, and I believe it's a dynamic because it reflects the image of God, who also has authority. Authority is not a bad thing. It brings order. Authority not well exercised is very dangerous because of its power. But it assumes authority, and it requires that those who have the position of authority in that culture and by expansion in any culture exercise the authority for the well-being of others. And when they have abused that authority and it has caused harm or social degradation to the one against whom they have acted, that authority is to be curbed, i.e. restricted. And the community, who is not directly addressed but is listening and receiving the law, is encouraged, invited, perhaps instructed, commanded to step in and provide protection for the one who is not protected against the one who has authority that has not been exercised well. So those are the findings I found in other passages. I have an article written on Deuteronomy 21, the captive woman passage. So you can refer to that. I'm going to dive now into the paper and try to read as much of it as I can so that we finish. There's so much I want to tell you. The title of the paper is Moses's Vision of Responsible and Compassionate Patricentrism in the Context of Marital Dysfunction. Don't worry, the rest of the paper is more understandable than the title. I didn't write the title. It's great and scholarly, but I didn't write it. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Scripture teaches that the ultimate purpose of Torah, that is God's instruction, the laws that we have in the Old Testament, is not merely to transform outward actions, but to foster a relational knowledge of God. And that's what I'll be talking about later on this afternoon. An invitation to Torah is an invitation to experientially know the character of God while simultaneously reflecting that character to the watching world. Thus, the study of Deuteronomic instruction is worth every bit of time and effort it requires, and it requires a lot. One mistake we make when we read Torah is underestimating its intended message. Contrary to how it may appear on the surface, Torah, that is biblical law, is an astonishingly comprehensive system of prescriptions that were to serve as the basis for guiding an entire society. Appropriate study of Torah will rarely, if ever, result in interpretations that focus on specific, limited, outward behavioral responses. Rather, it will produce a paradigm shift stemming from internal relational change and resulting in a far greater range of applicability than the specifics of its stated setting. I would love to go into that more, but that's what the next talk is about. A second mistake we made when reading Torah is assuming that in addressing how the righteous should live, it is describing something idyllic. In other words, we confuse walking in righteous obedience with living in ideal circumstances. Yet one of the most beautiful and encouraging characteristics of Torah is that God's instruction are given to fallen man in a fallen world. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 is no exception. Its setting reflects evidence of a painful and fractured relationship, namely divorce. Traditionally, this passage is read in light of questions regarding proper or improper grounds for divorce, and further, questions related to the appropriateness of remarriage or whether or not that remarriage would constitute adultery. Now, one of the reasons I'm pausing, I want to make sure we all know the passage that we're talking about. So I'm going to go ahead and read it to you quickly. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. I'm reading from the NIV. I don't care what translation we read from. They're all great. I use the Hebrew. If a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house. And if after she leaves his house, she becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, or if he dies, then her first husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. That would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Do not bring sin upon the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. I'm going to reread the line where I stopped because I think it's really important to hear. Traditionally, this passage is read in light of questions regarding proper and improper grounds for divorce, and further questions related to the appropriateness of remarriage or whether or not remarriage would constitute adultery. Thus, a text that prohibits a specific union, namely between a man and a woman he previously divorced, inappropriately becomes an injunction against any remarriage at all. The primary issue in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, is not the divorce, but the abuse that the divorce represents. In an earlier article, For Your Good Always, Restraining the Rights of the Victor for the Well-Being of the Vulnerable, Deuteronomy 21, 10 through 14, I posit that Deuteronomy's ideal vision for Israel's domestic life includes a head of household who exercises his authority for the well-being of his family. Moreover, the prescriptive texts addressing the head of household are intended to curb the potential abuse of power that his authority might otherwise invite. Thus, in familial settings, the instruction in Deuteronomy works both positively, promoting welfare, and negatively, preventing abuse, for the purpose of protecting and preserving righteousness in Israel. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, profoundly evidences these same conclusions. So first, let's talk about the setting. When I talk about the setting, I'm going to take a perspective where we look at the broadest setting first, and then work our way in toward those pieces that are most contextually relevant. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 is set against the backdrop of family life, but bears a closer resemblance to a soap opera than a Sunday school lesson. The passage concerns a marriage that ends in divorce, followed by a remarriage that also ends, either because of death or divorce, and the consideration of a third marital union, this time between a woman and her original husband. It gets messy, like real life. This marriage, divorce, remarriage, end of marriage chain provides the setting for the prohibition of Deuteronomy 24:4. Let's first look at the ancient Near Eastern background setting. The unique setting of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 has no direct parallel either in the scriptures or in the extant ancient Near Eastern texts. Yet study of ancient Near Eastern laws related to marriage and divorce reveal broader themes that help to inform the study of Deuteronomy 24. The most notable feature of ancient Near Eastern texts regarding marriage and family matters is their focus on economic issues. Again, I'm talking about non-biblical texts. As part of the overall concern with economic justice, the ancient texts address two specific issues, each which provide a partial parallel to the concern of Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. The first involves the question of a husband's right to claim his wife once she has married another. Now, the reason this one is significant, let me take a rabbit trail for just a sec. One of the problems with doing scholarship on a biblical text is that you not only have to engage the text, you have to engage the scholars. And sometimes they are asking questions that are beyond the scope of the text, I think. So one of the ways that this is read, one of the solutions offered, the reason that this marriage would be inappropriate, this remarriage, is that because of the marital union that makes people one when they're married, a remarriage later would constitute incest, or there would be something inherently repulsive in society at that time of going back to a prior spouse. And so that's the kind of issue that scholars are positing in an attempt to understand this passage. However, ancient Near Eastern texts argue that against the idea that there was a natural universal repulsion for a woman returning to her husband after an intervening relationship. Now, I'm not going to read all the laws, but from the Sumerian Handbook of Forms, Akkadian laws, etc., they have laws where they deal with the question socially of what happens if a man wants to take back his former wife. Now, the setting's entirely different, so it's not a direct parallel. The setting in these texts from many different cultures and regions at the time are that the man has left, and it's an issue of abandonment. Now, the answer that's given is if the abandonment was due to service to one's country, he didn't just run off, he was brought away to war. And if he made significant provision for her well-being, so she was left with enough food and care for 3 years or so, depending on the text, then when he returns, if he has been rightfully detained, even if it's many, many, many years later, and even if she has remarried, he can go back to her. She was his, and he cared for her, and he was detained rightfully according to those standards. Now, if he left for reasons other than military, or he didn't provide for her when he left, or there was no valid justification for why he remained away longer, then when he comes back, if she has already married another, he does not have say over her. So all these fascinating texts, but what this demonstrates is that the question of whether or not a former spouse can take his wife back, even if she's always already remarried, is not repugnant in the minds of the ancient Near Eastern world. A second parallel between extra-biblical texts in Deuteronomy 24:1-4 involves the expected treatment of a wife who faces severe medical complications that prohibit her from functioning as a healthy wife. So the parallel with this passage and the one in Deuteronomy 24 hinges on that something indecent. He finds something indecent and therefore divorces her. The text in Deuteronomy is not clear whether this is a moral indecency, I'll talk about this later in the paper, or if it is a physical malady. So again, the overlap is not exact. But if it were a physical malady, you will see that in the ancient Near Eastern texts, laws are given to protect her and to ask him to care for her. Laws of Lipit Ishtar from 1930 in Samaria, laws of Hammurabi, there's a number of them. The parallel between these texts and Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is by no means complete. The laws list specific ailments while the reference to erwat davar in our text, the uncleanness, nakedness of a thing, in Deuteronomy 24:1 is vague and elusive. Furthermore, it is never safe to assume that a law in one country would correspond directly with the law or practice of another country. However, it is notable that marriage standards in nations surrounding Israel included high expectations for a husband's treatment of a wife, such that they had laws based solely on the concern for the well-being of the woman. One of the passages mentions Labum disease. We don't know what it is. But if Labum disease, referenced in the laws of Hammurabi, was indeed a contagious skin disease, the wife was not only unable to act as wife, she was a potential health hazard to her husband and his household. Yet, according to Hammurabi, a noble man was to care for his wife even in this situation. Deuteronomic background. Contrary to popular treatment, Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is not the book's only comment on divorce. Deuteronomy 21:14, 22:19, and 22:29 all speak to the issue of a man sending his wife away, thereby terminating the marriage. Now, let me quickly read those passages for you in their context so that you know which ones we're talking about. Deuteronomy 21, the one that I referenced an article earlier, when you go to war against your enemies and the Lord delivers them into your hands and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home and have her shave her head, trim her nails, put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband. And Hebrew's pretty explicit about what that means. You may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. If you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her. So in that case, you have divorce that is allowed, if that's the question we're supposed to be asking the text. It is at least happening. And because it is happening, he is not to have any other say over her well-being. Deuteronomy 22:19 is the passage about the man who has slandered his young bride by claiming that she is not pure. There's been a trial, and if he is found guilty rather than she, so she is indeed virtuous, then the result for the male is that they shall find him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the girl's father, because this man has given an Israelite virgin a bad name. She shall continue to be his wife. He must not divorce her as long as he lives. And Deuteronomy 22:29, this is in the context of a man who, and I'm starting in 28, happens to meet a virgin who is not pledged to be married. And here I divert from the NIV because there's no verification that this is what it actually means. NIV says rapes. Hebrew just says lies with. There's no way to tell. And they are discovered. He shall pay the girl's father 50 shekels of silver. He must marry the girl, for he has violated her. He can never divorce her as long as he lives. So you have two instances where the first instance he does divorce, and the second two instances he's not allowed. Now let me take just a minute, risking our time, to give you some background socially in the ancient Near Eastern world. We consider offenses to be personal attacks on our well-being and character. So, for example, let's take the example of rape. If we are addressing an issue of rape or are a victim of rape, the violation is a personal one. In the ancient Near Eastern culture, the part of violation that would be seen, and this is a mind shift for us, and we have to adopt it and see it through their lenses, the violation is a social one. What happens to her as the person is less of a concern, not because there's no attention given to her personhood. No, she would feel this. And the text shows us this over and over in personal narratives with Tamar, in biblical law. It is the social degradation that is defining in this culture. And we'll, again, discuss this more this afternoon, but it's very, very important. That explains why a woman who was slept with before marriage, let's say it was rape, the text leaves that very open as a possibility. In our culture, we would put out a restraining order. He would never have rights to her again. In their culture, they say marry her and he may never divorce her. And what? But to her, this would be the more desirable. Because having had intercourse, whether it's rape or maybe she pursued him, before marriage makes her unmarriable and affects her social status. And the responsibility of that action in the text is laid at the feet of the man, not her. That's a pretty high responsibility socially. Very high responsibility. What I'm saying is this is not gender discrimination against females. This is high value being put on the position of power that the male has and calling him to a righteous action to it. Because he has disgraced her socially, the only positive outcome for that for her is to be married. And he may never divorce her because he would once again degrade her socially. It would be assumed that she can leave. But he can't make that decision against her because he has already acted against her. So this is why sometimes you can divorce, sometimes you can't. The times that divorce are prohibited in the Old Testament are the times when the woman has been wronged. And it's for the sake of protecting her in a different cultural setting than what we have. All right, let me go back to reading. This is why I'm trying to read and not talk the whole time. All right, so contrary to popular treatment, Deuteronomy 24 is not the book's only comment on divorce. Each of these passages that I read speak to the issue of a husband sending his wife away, thereby terminating the marriage. Regardless of one's persuasion concerning authorial issues in Deuteronomy, these passages provide a context that is closer in proximity, genre, style, and agenda than any of the extra biblical materials. Deuteronomy 21:14 demonstrates that divorce was socially degrading to the woman. Deuteronomy 24:19 and 22:29 reflect two contexts in which divorce is forbidden because the man involved has already enacted harm against the woman, and his authority to divorce her and cause her further social disgrace is curtailed. Thus, in all three other references to divorce in the book of Deuteronomy, the practice is seen as socially degrading at the very least. Further, whether divorce was exercised or forbidden, these three passages all represent situations in which the response to a man's initial harmful actions against a woman involve the restriction of his authority regarding future decisions that affect the woman's social status. Now let's look to the characters. The cast of characters in Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is simple. The scene involves two men and a woman. In this passage, the characters themselves seem less important than the circumstances in which they find themselves. There is no mention of other family members like children, other wives, or the bride's parents. Regarding the woman, the text says that after marrying her, the first husband is displeased with her. Literally, she does not find favor in his eyes, to the point of wanting to end the marriage because he finds something indecent, literally the nakedness of a thing, concerning her. The phrase erwat davar, the nakedness of a thing, is cryptic and vague, presumably by intention. The very nature of the phrase lends itself to obscurity, as language designed to express the unmentionable invites a hearer to understand that more is meant than is being said. Yet how much more and in what vein is not clearly spelled out in this context? Now, one of the big questions in scholarship is this a moral action that is she is at fault for, or is this a physical malady? You're going to hear me work through the different options, and basically the conclusion, I'll tell you ahead of time so that you can follow the arguments hopefully a little bit better, is that we can't tell. The text doesn't determine. It may be an moral difficulty the woman has, or a moral sin she has done, but the text leaves open the possibility that this is something that she has no control over. This may not be a moral thing. And if that possibility is there, then the text is talking about a broad potential backdrop. The noun erva, nakedness, which occurs 45 times in the Old Testament, literally means nakedness, specifically with regard to the parts of the body that are to remain discreetly covered. Figuratively, the word can function as a euphemism for sexual activity, usually inappropriate activity. However, it is also used metaphorically to describe hidden vulnerabilities. For example, the nakedness of a land means that it's easily attacked. Many of the contexts in which this word occurs also convey the idea of shame or humiliation. The specific phrase, ervat davar, the nakedness of a thing, found in Deuteronomy 24:1, occurs elsewhere only in Deuteronomy 23:15, where it refers to excrement. This is the part that says if you have to relieve yourself, go outside of the camp, so that God doesn't walk through and see the nakedness of a thing. Oh yeah, don't forget to cover it back up. All right? If the author is inviting the reader to compare these two occurrences, it may be significant that the ervat davar in Deuteronomy 23:15 refers to something that is private and even repulsive, but not unnatural. Nor would any fault be ascribed to a person for needing to relieve himself. Although we cannot know the precise nature of the problem, whether it's a hidden condition or a moral flaw, the woman of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 appears to struggle with something that is personal, private, and probably shameful. Though the text does not reveal the exact nature of the fault the man finds in the wife, the context does set limits on its severity. Since it is found in the context of marriage, ervat davar presumably refers to something that she could have kept hidden from all but her most intimate relationships. It is possibly shameful and may even be repulsive, but it is not so grave that it warrants the death penalty or exclusion from the Israelite community. If it was a lasting problem, such as a physical malady or imperfection, it was not serious enough to prohibit the woman from marrying a second time, nor does it necessitate divorce. The second husband could divorce her, or he could stay married to her and just die later, not related to the Erbat Debar. The marriage can end either way. Finally, it may be significant that the text traces the journey of the woman from one husband to the next. Nothing is said about what the first husband does after the divorce, and the second husband is so insignificant that whether or not he hates his wife doesn't even matter. His only role in the text, by the way, hate is the word for divorce, one of the words for divorce. His only role in this text is to marry her and then get out of the way. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 is a passage written to a male regarding his behavior toward a female that focuses more on the woman than the man. The issue then. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 addresses a man's right or lack thereof with reference to a woman once he has divorced her and after her subsequent marriage has ended. Most scholars agree that these first three verses form the prodesis, that would be the if part of an instruction, setting the stage for the actual instruction in verse 4. These verses are not intended as instruction for the acceptable grounds or methods of divorce. They merely indicate that in ancient Israel, divorce was accepted as a legitimate way to end a marital relationship. The prodesis, the if part, Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 3. As noted earlier, the situation described in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 3 involves a fairly complex set of circumstances. The primary setting is marriage, yet rather than marital bliss, this relationship fails to fulfill the expectations and ends in divorce. In its presentation of the demise of this relationship, two features of the text stand out. First, the grounds for the divorce are not disclosed in detail. Whatever this woman's defect, her husband finds it offensive enough that he no longer wishes to be married to her and sends her away from his household. As we heard earlier in the sermon, this could be anything from a burnt dish to a wandering wife. Whatever this woman's defect, I said that. Second, the wording of the text suggests that the problem in the text is more with the man's response to his wife's indecency than with the indecency itself. The first subtle clue to substantiate this involves the husband's response to his wife, "She did not find favor in his eyes." Lo timtza tzein ba'einav. To understand this phrase as simply implying that he was displeased is to fall short of its fuller meaning. The phrase itself occurs 43 times in the Hebrew scriptures and refers to situations in which one individual holds the power to affect the well-being of another for good or ill. Typically, in the scriptures, favor is sought from a person who holds a position of authority, even if that authority is relative or pertains only to a particular situation. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Many times it's someone requesting favor perhaps from a king or from a father. But sometimes, an example would be Jacob and Laban. Laban, who is superior to Jacob, requests favor from Jacob because Jacob holds the power of the decision. Laban says, "If I found favor in your eyes, don't take my daughters and go." And Jacob's the one that gets to make that decision, even though he is not in authority over Laban. So it's not just an authority word, it's whoever holds the power in that given situation. Finding favor usually involves a gracious deed enacted on behalf of the requesting party, one that involves kindness or goodwill rather than harm. The careful wording of Deuteronomy 24:1 conveys the husband's displeasure with his wife while hinting at the essence of the marital dilemma. She does not become the recipient of his favor. He does not extend grace to her. I'm not reaching there. The word for favor is chen, grace. The phrase ki matzaba ervat davar, because he finds something indecent concerning her, provides a second hint. The construct something indecent, nakedness of a thing, provides the grounds for this man's lack of favor with his wife. Without making light of the potential gravity of the situation or the surprise it may have caused her husband, the larger phrase in which it is couched suggests that the burden of appropriate response lies with the husband. Of the 55 occurrences of erva, nakedness, all but three, and this is one of them, appear in the immediate contexts of either seeing, there's one specific Hebrew word used, or uncovering slash covering, with, again, one specific Hebrew word for each of those. In each context, covering refers to concealing, hiding, protecting, and is the appropriate response. Whereas seeing or uncovering are used as negative responses, leading to shame and humiliation. Neither seeing nor covering or uncovering are used here in Deuteronomy 24. So we don't see the response. Rather, the text uses the ambiguous notion of finding matzah to identify the husband's initial involvement with the wife's situation. I posit that a reader familiar with the lexical propensities of nakedness is hereby invited to entertain a brief moment of suspense. He has found something. We know that when he finds nakedness, there are two responses that are possible. Do you reveal it? Do you protect it? Hide it? Will the husband reveal his wife's hidden shame and cover, or will he cover her nakedness, protecting her from the prying eyes of a larger community? Will he hide her indecency or uncover her secret? In the scenario presented in Deuteronomy 24:1-4, the husband responds by issuing his wife a certificate of divorce and sending her away. The divorce certificate is traditionally viewed as a document of great benefit to the woman. The divorce certificate grants her freedom, freedom to do as she wished, and freedom from any future interference by her former husband. The document is mentioned again in verse 3 as part of the hypothetical second divorce and may well have been a part of standard divorce procedure. The proposal that divorce certificate existed to ensure a woman's freedom, this is what scholars posit, is consistent with the evidence from the ancient Near Eastern world. So usually it's, look, this is a good thing. She's given a certificate of divorce. It protects her. And I agree. Nevertheless, however beneficial a divorce certificate may have been, it was a public document recording the humiliating reality of a divorce. Any indiscretion she had previously concealed is now fodder for public discussion. By divorcing this woman publicly on grounds of her indecency, this man uncovers her shame to the world. I cannot help but think of Joseph and his response when I read this. I bet he knew the Old Testament. After being given the divorce certificate and sent away from her husband's house, the woman goes out and marries another. The second marriage is confounding. This is the problem in scholarship with this passage. The marriage itself seems to provide a pivotal plot twist, yet from the perspective of the text, it appears that the second husband is significant only in this. He exists. Semantically speaking, he doesn't even take the initiative in marrying the woman. She becomes his wife, and the marriage ends. It does not matter whether the marriage ends by divorce or death. It might be said that the most impressive textual feature of the second relationship is its insignificance. What then is the relevance of the second marriage, and how does its taking place affect the previous relationship? Now, let me pause here once more just for a second to give you some background. Typically, when this passage is discussed, it is read through the lenses of New Testament comments by Jesus that identify, and I'm not going to go into the whole issues, but there are different ways to read this. I'm aware of that in the New Testament. But the idea is that the second marriage causes adultery. And so when scholars read back into this passage, they have that lens already. At the very least, the husband's presence signifies that this woman who was cast aside by her former husband does have value as a wife. The woman was not unlovable. Her deformity is not so hideous that a marriage is unthinkable for her. One might even infer from the text that she's capable of a lasting relationship. The text allows that her second husband might divorce her, but also allows that he might choose to stay married to her for the length of his life. Thus, one can conclude that her defect does not necessitate divorce. Finally, the second husband is significant in that he gets out of the way. In order for the question of the first husband's rights to be addressed, the second marriage must come to a legitimate end. In summary, the phrase, "she finds no favor in his eyes," seems to highlight that the fact that the husband did not demonstrate grace to his wife. Two, the text does not reveal the specific reason for the husband's disfavor. The reference to Erevat Davar probably refers to something private, hidden, probably shameful, possibly not her fault, and his discovery of which is likely due to his position as her husband. Three, the morally neutral use of matzah to find in the phrase he found something indecent concerning her may suggest that the husband has a choice in how he handles the matter of his wife's defect. He can cover her indecency or expose her shame to the community. Although a divorce certificate probably served as protection from a divorced husband, it was also likely a form of public disgrace. At the very least, it signified a social demotion in Israelite culture. That's what divorce is in Israelite culture. At the worst, it may have involved revealing that which had been hidden and thus inviting further shame to the woman. Five, the text provides little concrete information regarding her second marriage. The only condition is that the marriage ends. Six, the inclusion of a second marriage and its potential for success underscores the value of the woman. And seven, in ancient Israel, the husband likely held the primary position of authority in matters of divorce, because in those overlapping spheres of social and family, divorce involves both. So in the family, they may have been equal, but divorce is a social construct. Apodosis, Deuteronomy 24:4. This is the then part. The first husband who divorced may not remarry her. The main issue, the restriction of man's rights to remarry a former wife after he has divorced her and she has been remarried, is straightforward. Yet the rationale behind this restriction remains elusive. The rationale begins with the phrase, Ahare Asher Hutama'a. I'll translate that for you in just a minute, but I'm not going to try to here for complexities that I will explain in a minute. A phrase that is troublesome because it contains only one of four examples of the Hotpa'al stem in the Hebrew Bible. Now, those of you who don't know Hebrew, that means nothing to you. But this isn't one of four examples of this word. It's one of four examples of this kind of verb. So it's broader even than the word. It's very, very, very limited. So even our understanding of the way it's functioning in the sentence is limited. Based on Waltke and O'Connor's proposal for outlining the Hebrew verbal system based on the voice of the subject of the sentence, and the under-subject, the object, pretty much, John Walton argues convincingly that the verb should be translated, she has been made, there's a cause involved, that's common in the Hebrew verbal system, she has been made, caused, to declare herself, this is what we refer to as reflexive, action that is done back unto yourself, unclean. This translation shifts the emphasis from what she does, some texts, she is defiled, she is unclean, she declares, you can read the translations. It shifts the emphasis from what she does to what is done to her. This shift in focus affects the interpretation of the entire passage. What scholars often view as a statement of judgment concerning this woman's impurity is really a statement of judgment upon the person and the process that forced her into a situation of public disgrace. The specific nature of this uncleanness in the woman can be attributed to the fact that one, so this is the first option, divorce sent her to the arms of a second husband, and in remarrying she committed adultery, thus becoming unclean. By the way, I don't think I've mentioned this here, but the hotpa'al, that weird verb form, is being used with the verb tameh, which means unclean. So we know what that word means. It's just how unclean, what dynamic of uncleanness is talking about here. First option, that because she's divorced, she has to remarry. And in remarrying, she commits adultery, and then she's labeled as unclean. Or a second option, through the process of divorcing her first husband, she was forced to reveal an uncleanness that was previously hidden, declaring herself unclean in the eyes of the community. Either way, the text is explaining a way that she was wronged rather than setting her up as the one who is wrong. That's the fundamental point. I'm going to explore the two options quickly because scholars care deeply about this. Option one, the first husband's act of divorcing his wife caused her to remarry, and that marriage constituted adultery. The support for this interpretation is threefold. One, adultery does cause a person to become unclean. Two, the interpretation would provide an explanation for the inclusion of the second marriage in the passage. Well, this is why that second guy is even there. And three, later biblical treatment of the topic could suggest that this passage involves unfaithfulness and/or adultery. However, the difficulties with this interpretation outweigh its strengths. One, while adultery can cause a person to become unclean, the Old Testament records many other means by which a person can be defiled. Two, in other words, it doesn't have to be adultery. Uncleanness refers to lots of things, some of which are not moral, amoral, not related to morality. Two, if the second marriage constituted a sin as serious as adultery, an offense punishable by death, one might expect concerns about the second marriage to be addressed directly. More importantly, Leviticus 21:14 seems to suggest that marrying a divorced woman would have been acceptable for anyone other than a priest. So in that passage, priests are held to a higher standard and they may not marry divorcees. The implication being someone else might be able to marry divorcees. I would say would. Three, it is difficult to see how the divorce forces her into a second marriage. In ancient Israel, it was difficult for a woman to survive without the protection of a male household, but the woman may have had other economic options, such as turning to a father or a brother for support. If divorce automatically led to adultery because it necessitated remarriage, it would seem odd that Exodus 21:7-11 would require that a husband allow divorce should he neglect his wife. Finally, fourth, interpreting the second marriage as adultery does not explain why the instruction in the text restricts only the first husband from subsequently remarrying her. Thus, it does not seem possible that the defilement referred to in Deuteronomy 24:4 can be linked to remarriage in general. The second option, then, the first husband's act of divorcing his wife exposes her uncleanness. This interpretation goes against most scholarly treatments of the passage, but it finds several points of support in context. One, beginning in the Protasis, that's the first three verses, the text suggests that the problem with the marriage is deeper than the nature of the nakedness of a thing attributed to the wife. The husband is portrayed as less than gracious with his wife's situation. He finds a flaw or imperfection that may be related to the reference to uncleanness in 24:4. Do you understand that when you add the word unclean to this, it almost shoots the reader back to the nakedness of a thing, and you have to figure out the relationship between them. Is that the unclean thing? Her defect would not have been public knowledge until exposed through the divorce procedure. Two, the apodosis, that's verse 4, identifies the man as the first husband who divorced her. The additional phrase, who divorced her, draws attention to the man's social humiliation of this word. As the passive object of the de-stem verb, sorry, non-Hebrew people, that means he did this to her. He caused her to be this way, passive. The woman is acted on by an outside agent, grammatically shifting the focus of the text from the woman's uncleanness to the harm that came from the husband's treatment of her. Three, the recognition of divorce as socially degrading act harmful to the woman corresponds with the larger content and context of Deuteronomic Torah. Four, extra-biblical evidence suggests that the disposal of an unwanted wife would have been unacceptable. Although such evidence must be applied with extreme caution, ancient Near Eastern law codes from Babylon suggest that a man is responsible to care for his wife, showing her value even when she cannot contribute to a family. Two challenges with this interpretation, mine presented in the paper, must be considered. The first involves an underlying assumption that the strong language at the end of the verse is considered more appropriately descriptive of adultery than divorce. Okay, sorry, this isn't a challenge with my interpretation. However, the did you understand that since I paused? Usually tame is looked at, and because it's such a strong word, unclean, people's minds instantly go to divorce. The abomination of remarriage to a former wife after intervening marriage need not be an issue of sexual purity. While abomination, that's the very strong word used in Hebrew, typically refers to idolatry, cultic offenses, or sexual impurity, the term is also used for measuring with false weights to cheat one's neighbor, a context that is entirely devoid of sexuality. The identification of false weights as an abomination demonstrates that those things loathed by God extend beyond sins like idolatry and adultery to include man's unjust treatment of others. The action labeled as an abomination in verse 4 is the possibility of remarriage to the first husband because of his previous treatment of her. In divorcing his wife, this man demonstrated a disregard for her as an individual and for his covenant commitment to her. He exercised his authority in a manner that placed his own interests ahead of his responsibility to care and provide for his wife. Such behavior is loathsome to the Lord. The second challenge to the interpretation that the later biblical evidence indicates divorce and remarriage involve covenant unfaithfulness or adultery is that the New Testament passages on the subject pose a particular challenge in that they identify the second marriage as adultery. Yet one must be careful not to interpret an earlier text in light of a later one. While this second marriage might be considered adulterous, according to the New Testament, its status as such does not appear to be the primary focus of Deuteronomy 24:1-4. Rather, the focus of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is on the husband's unfaithful treatment of his wife, a point echoed by Jesus in Matthew 5:31-32. The closest Old Testament support for interpreting the second marriage as adultery is found in Jeremiah 3:1. Let's go to that. I'll read that passage to you. I won't be able to give you all of the context, but you should be able to pick it up quickly. In Jeremiah 3:1, it says, "If a man divorces his wife, and she leaves him and marries another, should he return to her again?" A clear allusion back to the law in Deuteronomy 24:1-4. Would not the land be completely defiled? But you have lived as a prostitute with many lovers. Would you now return to me, declares the Lord. So God uses this as an indictment against adultery in the form of idolatry, the metaphor, in Israel at that time. In the conventional understanding, the link between Jeremiah 3:1 and Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is understood as emphasizing that just as a man would not return to his former wife, so Yahweh would not return to Israel because she had been unfaithful. With its reference to prostitution, zina of the people, Jeremiah 3:1 seems to create a link between Israel and the wife of Deuteronomy 24:1-4. So the passage gets really tied up into the gender, and we see the her and we associate it with the her, thus suggesting that the wife's action of remarriage constitutes unfaithfulness, possibly in the form of adultery. Jeremiah there is highlighting the sin of Israel and pointing to the expectation that Yahweh, metaphorically the first husband, would never be expected to take her back. Such things are just not done. They're forbidden by Torah. This is one explanation of Jeremiah 3 that makes it look like this passage in Deuteronomy is actually about the adultery that would be caused by a second marriage. However, it is possible to understand the link between Deuteronomy 24:1-4 and Jeremiah 3:1 according to the interpretation of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 presented in this paper. In fact, the text of Jeremiah 3:1 seems to demand it. The beginning of Jeremiah 3:1 summarizes the instruction in language that is clearly reminiscent of Deuteronomy 24. Following the summary of Torah, Yahweh repeats the question, this time reframing it so that the roles are properly identified. Would you, Israel, return to me? The one prohibited from returning is not Yahweh, but Israel. The link between Jeremiah 3:1 and Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is not between adultery and prostitution, but between two spouses who have acted offensively toward their marriage partner. The husband, who divorced his wife in Deuteronomy 24, and Israel, the she, who was unfaithful to Yahweh in Jeremiah 3. Yahweh is not the one who has divorced in Jeremiah 3, but the one who has been wronged. The question, as I believe Israel would have heard Jeremiah 3:1, becomes then, does a spouse who has been socially degraded and treated with utmost disregard return to their abuser? Certainly not. Not only does this interpretation of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 work in the Jeremiah passage, it is all the more poignant for the Jeremiah passage. Based on the evidence, this hotpael of unclean seems to be referring to the fact that the wife was forced to reveal her uncleanness or declare herself unclean publicly in the divorce procedure. Ultimately, however, even if someone maintains the view that divorce caused the woman to remarry and thus to commit adultery, the emphasis in verse 4 is on the person, the first husband, and the process, divorce, by which this woman was made unclean. In Deuteronomy 24:1, this husband assumed the right to divorce his wife. The harm this caused her is the basis for the restriction of his ability to cause further and future harm. Conclusion. It has been argued above that Deuteronomy 24:1-4 restricts a man's presumed right to remarry a woman based on his earlier treatment of her. As her husband, this man was to offer her provision and protection, if not also love and grace. Yet he uses his position as her husband to bring her harm, deeming her unworthy of living in his household. For whatever grounds, he rejects her publicly, exposing her to social degradation and humiliation. The public degradation of divorce, coupled with the humiliation and shame of being declared unclean, demonstrates a lack of regard for the well-being of his wife. Having demonstrated that he cannot be trusted to care for her well-being, his future rights over the woman are nullified. Thus, a passage that typically is treated as a divorce text is really addressing the abuse that divorce represents. One might argue that understanding Deuteronomy 24:1-4 as a passage that is not just about divorce, but about the abuse which divorce represents, is inconsistent with the strong words against divorce in Malachi 2:16, I hate divorce. Yet this presentation of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 in no way lessens the offense of divorce. In fact, this instruction is a strong commentary on the sanctity of marriage and the offense of divorce. Further, this interpretation of Deuteronomy 24:1-4 adds elements of humanity and dignity to a topic that can often be treated with distance. Imagine the relief of a man or woman who hears in Malachi 2:16, not, you are offensive because you have divorced, but rather, I, Yahweh, am offended for you because you were wronged through divorce. Or in reverse, imagine the challenge to the one who hears not, I hate that you partook in a practice I despise, but I hate that you treated with disregard and disdain one you should have loved and protected. At the beginning of the paper, I mentioned that one of the biggest mistakes we make with Torah is reading it superficially. Torah presents a picture of righteous response within a fallen world. In this case, the restriction in verse 4 really is intended only for the first husband. He has wronged the one he was to protect, and the community is to stand for her so that he cannot wrong her again. The brokenness is assumed, and instead of asking of Deuteronomy 24:1-4, can one divorce or can one remarry? looking for ways to avoid all sin. We should be asking, how do we protect the harmed? Imagine if the church fully grasped this passage. The stigma would no longer plague the divorced one, and the church would not withdraw in confusion from the ones we were instructed to protect. Please also note that this is not a gender issue. While in ancient Israel, a husband would have held more authority and more freedom based on economic security in matters of divorce, Jeremiah 3:1 identifies the unfaithful wife as the one who may not return. So in Deuteronomy, it's the husband who may not return. In Jeremiah, it's the wife, metaphorically Israel, who may not return. Abuse of relationship can work in either direction. Further to the charge that we not read Torah superficially, we must also acknowledge that while marriage and divorce is the setting of Deuteronomy 24:1-4, it need not be its sole application. As Paul points to the ox threshing as grounds for discussing compensation, Deuteronomy 24:1-4 is drawing a picture to shape a paradigm that is to guide broader attitudes and behavior. Behavior that reflects Yahweh's own righteous character to our community and to the watching world. Deuteronomy 24:1-4, the message is clear. One must not use his or her influence to bring harm. And when abuse of relationship has happened, that influence must be curtailed. Thank you.